Imagine it's March 1799. You're in a tavern in Milford Township, Pennsylvania, 45 miles north of Philadelphia. You're a federal tax assessor, and you're exhausted after riding around the area all day trying to collect a new tax on real estate. Already, people are refusing to pay. You're hoping that if you can just explain the tax, maybe you can diffuse tensions. So inside this crowded tavern, you stand to try and make your case.
Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon. If I can have everyone's attention, please, please. I said good afternoon. Thank you. Thank you. I am the principal tax assessor for this county. And I'm here to inform you about the various provisions of the new tax law. I'm sure you'll all come to understand that it's really quite reasonable.
You're about to continue with your speech when the door opens and a dozen men stride into the tavern. One of them is carrying a flag with the word Liberty emblazoned across it. And all at once, the patrons start talking again. This doesn't look promising, but you're determined to do your job. You take a deep breath and press on.
If you would all just listen, I'm sure you will be reassured about the fairness of this tax. Please.
You look down at the piece of parchment in your hand and begin to read the law aloud.
Section 1.
The Federalists have no right to make such a law.
This is government oppression, no better than the British Crown.
The man who interrupted you pushes through the crowd to stand just a few feet away. He's wearing a tattered old Continental Army uniform, and he's looking at you with utter disgust.
Sir, if you would just let me explain the law. You're cheating us. I know you are. I'll bet all the money you collect from us.
You throw up your arms in frustration at the accusation.
I can assure you, I'm doing no such thing. I'm here to administer the law. But we don't want any of your damn laws. I'll never submit to having my house taxed. That's preposterous. It's my house. As citizens of this country, I'm afraid you just don't have a choice. Well, we'll see about that.
The room is seething with anger. Your meeting is turning into a protest. You know you're not able to change their minds today, so you push through the crowd to leave. You just hope this doesn't escalate into a full-fledged revolt. You're not sure the country can take any more bloodshed. American History Tellers is sponsored by Audible. I like puzzles. I like adventure. I like clever people. I like things on the edge, which means I love mysteries. The perfect combination of storytelling, mental challenge, and often murder. Like in the Penguin modern classic, Perfume, The Story of a Murderer by Patrick Susskind. And as an Audible member, I can choose one title every month to keep forever from the entire catalog of classics, bestsellers, new releases, and Audible originals, ready to listen whenever, wherever, on the Audible app. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/tellers or text tellers to 500-500. That's audible.com/tellers or text tellers to 500-500. American History Tellers is sponsored by Audible. Listen to a new bold take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Ilan Ishkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. A chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion, now more relevant than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother. From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American History Tellers. Our history, your story. Five years after the Whiskey Rebellion unleashed terror in western Pennsylvania, a new rebellion against federal taxes erupted 300 miles to the east. In 1799, the U.S. government imposed a new tax on houses, land, and slaves to fund an expanded military. A man named John Freeze led Pennsylvania Dutch farmers in protest of the law. What became known as Freeze Rebellion was the third major tax revolt in the nation's short history. John Freeze had marched west with the army that suppressed the Whiskey Rebels. He and his neighbors learned crucial lessons from the failure of the Whiskey Rebellion and Shays Rebellion. This time, not a single shot was fired. The farmers acted with tremendous restraint, using nonviolent protest to petition their representatives. They focused their opposition on the law, President John Adams, and the Federalist Party, not on the authority of the U.S. government itself. Nonetheless, President Adams quashed Free's rebellion with military force, a response widely viewed as an overreaction, one that might have cost him re-election. The protesters' actions proved that Americans could challenge their government without resorting to violence, and that popular dissent could exist within the rule of law, affirming a tradition of protest that exists to this day. In today's episode, we take a deeper dive into how the early American rebellions were resolved and what that era of our nation's history can teach us about how the government handles pushback from citizens today. For more on that, I'm speaking with Pulitzer-winning historian and legal scholar Edward J. Larson. Larson is a history professor and Hugh and Hazel Darling Chair in Law at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California. He is also author of the new book, Franklin and Washington, The Founding Partnership. Here's our conversation. Ed Larson, welcome to American History Tellers.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you've written several books on America in the late 18th century and the unrest that was prevalent at the time. But what is something that most of us don't realize about the issues that people were facing in this era in America?
As you know, we get a pretty rosy picture presented in our general history about the Revolutionary era, but it was a lot tougher than generally presented. One of the things was, when we're talking about when the Revolution ended, the enormous economic collapse, the depression that fell on to the now newly independent states, without those states having the capability to deal with that economic recession or depression. Now, the causes were obvious in retrospect. We'd had all that pent-up spending during the war. We had benefited from tariff protection before the war. And now after the war, people went on a spending spree and nobody'd take our dollars. So all of our gold went over to Europe or even to Asia to buy goods, but nobody'd buy our goods because they had tariff walls against our country. We were no longer within any empire's trading system and we were on our own. And so they could build walls against us, but because of the way, you know, the post-revolutionary settlement was, there was no central government that could impose tariffs against foreign goods, and therefore we were a wide open market. The result was an economic collapse throughout the colonies, which limited economic opportunity just when people had the greatest hopes that with the revolution won, we would have paradise. Second also was the closure of the frontier. Because there was no central government, there was no army. There was no way to open the frontier. The British still, contrary to the Treaty of Paris, they retained their troops in the forts in the Northwest Territories, in the Ohio country, as it were. Plus, the Native Americans weren't about ready to step aside voluntarily. So we had no way to protect the frontier, which was under technically the domain of the central government. And the frontier for America had always been our safety valve. That's where people could go who were ambitious, who didn't have opportunity. Suddenly that was closed. So when you combine the economic collapse in the colonies, which limited economic opportunity, plus the closing of the frontier under the Articles of Confederation, the result was people, just when they were hoping for good times, didn't get them.
Well, not only do we have an economic collapse, but we have a collapse of direction as well. I mean, the American Revolution was probably the one thing that Americans banded together for, their independence. After 1776, or the victory thereafter, they didn't have the same common cause. Splintering began immediately. What were some of the first divides that emerged in our country at that time?
Lindsay, that's a great observation, because the economic collapse simply accelerated and made worse this splintering. Part of the splintering was, of course, economic. We'd always had rich and poor people in America. That had been the way. But there were people who thought during the revolution that somehow things would be better after it. And so the poor built up their hopes. And of course, many of the poor people served in the military. That's who, by the end of the war, most of the troops were from the lower classes. They had high hopes. And when the war ended and peace returned, you had that restoration of some people doing quite well and some people crashing down into poverty that was only made worse because of the economic recession. Then you add to that the frustrated hopes of the slaves. Many slaves thought that somehow the revolution would include them. They heard the rhetoric, and it didn't seem to play out. There was some freeing of slaves in Virginia, but for the most part, the old slave and free separation was reinforced, which made it even more frustrating for many of the slaves because their hopes were frustrated. And it wasn't just slave and free, but it was also white and black. After the revolution, with some increasing freeing of slaves in places like Virginia and the ending of slavery in the North, there became an institutionalized divide, sort of to put it in much later terms, a Jim Crow type apartheid, separate in the North and more so in Virginia, where they actually passed laws saying that all the freed slaves had to leave Virginia. So there was an institutionalizing of white and black. Yet during the revolution, there had been actually quite a few black soldiers in the revolution. The free African Americans in places like Massachusetts and Rhode Island made up a significant minority of the militia. And suddenly their hope. So what we had was a splintering along rich, poor, slave free, black, white, Native American that was aggravated by the frustrated hopes of the revolution. And you lay on top of that, that led to the partisan divide. More than anything, the splintering happened along the developments of political parties. We never really had political parties in America. Maybe a few states, there was some sense of political parties in Pennsylvania and New York before the revolution. But after the revolution, during the run-up to the Constitutional Convention, and especially after it, there is a growing partisan split as these different interest groups, farmers versus urban folks, craftsmen versus business owners, rich, poor, immigrants and non-immigrants, banded together into political parties that we'd never seen before, which the people at the Constitutional Convention, people like George Washington, never anticipated the rise of partisan politics that caused, that was the manifestation of the splintering you're talking about.
Well, let's talk about George Washington. He faced pretty much a perfect storm of ingredients for uprising, an economic collapse, a lowered prosperity, widening of income gaps, dashed hopes from the fight for independence, and then a tax on whiskey to try to pay for the debt of the war. This whiskey rebellion, the refusal to pay the tax, and violently even, was the first big crisis in Washington's presidency. How do you think it changed him as a president and leader of our country?
The whiskey rebellion was a frustrating experience for Washington. Washington, like others, hoped for this Republican virtue and that people would continue to pull together as they had pulled together during the revolution. The Whiskey Rebellion, as you note, had lots of causes. Part of it was to bring the frontier under control, since much of the whiskey was made on the frontier because you couldn't get the grain to market from the frontier. So distilling it into whiskey made it more transportable. Also, Hamilton's economic program, Alexander Hamilton's economic program, had called for the federal government absorbing all the state debt from the revolution, which made that huge debt that had to be paid off that you're talking about. And so there went the tax on whiskey. Also, the whiskey, of course, would be taxed because it would fall on people who had less political clout. It wasn't the wealthy people, the bankers, the people that Hamilton traditionally aligned himself with. And so here was a, as you're describing it, it was a class revolution. It was frontier versus the coast. It was the poor, laboring white people versus the more elites. And so Washington was put on charge of an army. As you noted, the largest army he'd ever led, bigger than the army during any time of the revolution, put up there by Hamilton and sent off to quell this rebellion. And frankly, it embarrassed Washington once he got out there. It reconnected him with the common man, as it were. He had this association when he was a frontier surveyor. He was always part of the elite, but he had this working relationship. He didn't live in an ivory tower because of his time on the frontier. He knew these common people, as he might call them, and he reconnected with them. And when he did, just as originally, he both sympathized with them and he distrusted them. You can see in his letters when he went out to the frontier, both before the revolution and immediately after the revolution, and now when he goes out with the Whiskey Rebellion, he really sympathizes with these people, and he ends up pardoning those that he captures. But he also distrusts them. He distrusts their ignorance. He distrusts the fact that they're not like him, disciplined, who made something of himself by practicing virtue and by working hard. It also sensitized him to the level of opposition, that there was a growing partisan divide. And I think it helped influence, first, ultimately, his decision not to stay in office indefinitely, but also when he does leave, to call for an end of partisanship, that partisanship is going to destroy the country. So he has a mixed reaction. It deepens him in the sense that it reacquaints him with what Americans are facing, but he also increases his distrust of whether democracy can really work.
That distrust of democracy was already in place in America, certainly before Washington became president, because, of course, there was no president prior to him. There was no constitution. We were working under the Articles of Confederation, which proved to have some major flaws. And this brings me to Shay's Rebellion. Tell us about that revolt's role in ratifying the Constitution that we have now today.
Shay's Rebellion played an essential role. When you look back, historians suggest that it will maybe not be as significant as we think it is, because it wasn't as big as some people portrayed it. But it was huge. If you look at the letters by people like Madison and Washington and even Benjamin Franklin, you can see that this revolution, the way it was portrayed to them in the press, well, I guess to put it in the vernacular, scared the bejesus out of them. That here they saw former soldiers, former officers in the American Revolution, rising up, overthrowing the local tax collectors, the local mortgage, the local banks, the local courthouses to stop the foreclosures of their farms, which they viewed as, these people like Washington viewed as, an assault on basic property rights put in place by democratically elected governments. And that fear that the states couldn't handle this sort of revolt, and the need therefore to have a stronger central government that could maintain liberty but also property rights, because for many of these people like Washington, their property rights were an essential part of liberty. And then they would compare it with states like Rhode Island, which seemed to them to be knuckling to the debtors and forgiving debts or producing a radically inflated currency, which has the same effect as nullifying debts. And so you combine with the reaction in Massachusetts with the actions in Rhode Island, and it drove people to believe, many people, that we need a stronger central government that can act as a governor over all this, control interstate commerce, control the money supply, have a force able to go in and deal with these situations, centralize these issues, and instead of having each state deal with these economic problems alone, have one central government that could put tariffs on foreign goods, control international commerce, but also have total control over interstate commerce. When you put those things together, Shay's Rebellion had a tremendous psychological effect nationwide throughout the country that both propelled the meeting of the Constitutional Convention. It's the one thing that made sure that George Washington showed up at the convention, and without him there, it wouldn't have worked, and then helped push ratification.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
So now we have a constitution ratified, the new structure for our governance as a new nation. But these rebellions, before and after the ratification of the constitution, tested our early American ideals, our new focus on individual liberty, and the First Amendment. The First Amendment is clear that people can assemble peacefully. Protest certainly is an American institution. How do you think those exercising First Amendment rights now and throughout history and these rebellions are similar and different? How have these rebellions, Shays and Whiskey, informed our government's handling of pushback from civilians today?
They were educational experiences, as you suggest. I mean, they were American events. Now, originally, the First Amendment didn't apply to the states. It only applied to the states, you know, in the 20th century. So those rights of assembly and free press, those were just guaranteed against by the First Amendment against the central government. So individual states had to deal with these developments on their own. It could pass their own laws. But we see through these popular local revolts, and we give a lot of attention to Shays' Rebellion, but there were similar risings of the regulators, as they were usually called, to stop foreclosures. They happened in Virginia. They happened in North Carolina. They happened in other places as well with similar causes. And they teach us that citizens in a republic do have more power to push against their government than they would in a monarchy or in a theocracy or in a military dictatorship, that republics tend to be more responsive to revolts, whether they be revolts at the ballot box or riots in the streets or against the draft or against other activities. They tend to be more responsive unless they go too far and cause a counter reaction. But generally, the American Republican government, as with the Shays Rebellion, would be a good example of that. You have that shock, and then you get to the next election, and you have a political system that can absorb the shock of that revolt, and then people can go to the polls and come up with a new government. You're not stuck with the same king. You're not stuck with the same pope. You're not stuck with the same military dictator. You can have an outlet where this steam can go off, and then you can adjust and elect a new leader, such as Massachusetts, getting rid of Bowdoin and replacing him with John Hancock. And that new person now has, or that new senators or the new governors, the new president, whatever it is. It happened the same thing with the reaction against the hard-handed policies of John Adams with the election of 1800. In could come Thomas Jefferson and free all the people who had been arrested by the Alien and Sedition Acts and have a reaction to it. So the American system developed an ability to absorb those shocks and turn those revolts or riots into constructive resolutions that ended up coming up with a peaceful, quasi-democratic, quasi-republican compromise that allowed us to muddle ahead.
These shocks, of course, have happened throughout our American history. There's the constant pendulum swing of action and reaction, but also of unity and then partisanship. These adjustments, these reactions are part of what moves history, American history, forward. Can you share some examples of other shocks throughout history and how this pendulum has moved?
The American people, we see in their reaction to Shays' Rebellion, we see in their reaction to the Whiskey Rebellion, which, you know, at first was really harsh and then backed off. The tax was dealt with. Same way with the early movements of Southern states for nullifying the tariffs that ended up being a predecessor to the Civil War. There, the tariff was lowered. We're able to sort of react for the most part. A great example would be the Great Depression. Here, Hoover tried a very firm reaction, and the American people pulled back and elected a Democratic Congress in 1930 elections, and then in 1932 elected Roosevelt, who came up with a new set of plans. The reaction to the earlier pandemic with the Spanish flu and the repression following World War I led to a repudiation of Wilson. The Democrats first lost the Senate in the middle of the pandemic and the House of Representatives in the middle of the Spanish flu pandemic. And then 2 years later, in a return to normalcy, Harding beat the Democratic candidate who was trying to follow Wilson. So we have this sort of reaction, this absorbing of these shocks that happened throughout. And what you see through it all, I think, is that American peoples, we tend to be a pretty pragmatic people. We're a pretty practical people. That is, we're not that ideological. We don't look for doctrinaire solutions. We look for pragmatic sort of solutions. We're sort of living in the shadow of Ben Franklin, who was the personification of pragmatism, of trying to work out, take one day at a time and try to make that day better. We're not otherworldly. We don't look to way to the future. We are somewhat distrusting of our leaders and experts. We sort of want to work it out one day at a time. Now, the one danger is that tends to make us very short-sighted. We look toward dealing with the immediate problems immediately. And maybe we overlook long-term problems. So it makes us probably more able to deal with a pandemic in a pragmatic way once we get used to it, more able to deal with the shock of a Shays' Rebellion and come up with the pragmatic compromise. But maybe if there's an existential threat like climate change, that's a long way off, it doesn't put us in a very good role to deal with that sort of problem.
Changing topics a little bit, in our series, we also talked about the rebellions which probably had the best cause, the slave revolts. We also talked about how the Haitian Revolution instilled fear in white Americans about slave uprisings on American shores. What happened in Haiti, and how did it influence the outcome of Gabriel's Rebellion, for instance, and how Virginians responded to the rebellion?
The rebellion in Haiti was fire bell in the night. I think that was a phrase later used. Haiti was the most prosperous European colony in the Americas at the time. By the 1780s, 1790s, it was a sugar colony. It was France's sugar colony. Enormous wealth. Sugar was as gold was before, and the gold was to the Spanish Empire as oil is today, and we fight wars over oil, or at least we did until the collapse of the oil price a few weeks ago. With sugar, white gold was an enormous sense of wealth. It's almost amazing to look back, to look at the percentage of the British and French foreign economy for their empires that came from their sugar colonies. One reason America was able to win the revolution is when France joined our side, England had to shift most of their troops down to the Caribbean to defend their sugar colonies because they cared a lot more about whether they could hold on to Barbados than whether they could hold on to Massachusetts because it was worth more. And so when the French Revolution broke out with its tremendous ideals of liberty, equality, and fraternity, coupled with the collapse that the Reign of Terror in France brought and the collapse of French power and the French military, well, that was a breeding ground for revolution in Haiti because Haiti had become so concentrated on producing sugar, an enormous percentage, 90% or more of their people were black slaves producing this sugar with a very small level of incredibly wealthy colonists, French colonists living atop this seething mass of enslaved humanity. So you compare that with any place in America, because that's the comparison that you're getting at. South Carolina, what, maybe two-thirds of the people were enslaved blacks and one-third white. Virginia, maybe 50-50, maybe 40% enslaved blacks, 60% whites. You're dealing with that sort of percentages. In Haiti, it was much higher, 90%. And then you had the collapse of the French power, their ability to project the military power over onto Haiti. And then the ideals and dreams roused up among the enslaved Africans with these ideas of liberty, equality, and fraternity. And so you get an explosion. And the result is this huge, huge majority of black people are able to violently overthrow their masters, kill many of them, drive them out, recapture Haiti. And when the French, the weakened French, try to reinstate power, they fail. They send troops over and it fails. So Haiti successfully revolts in the shadow of the American Revolution. Now, this naturally is widely publicized in America, and it's publicized in a partisan way. It gets into the partisan politics. Well, you can look at the newspaper, the partisan newspapers back then, and those trying to cater to a certain class of fear that people had, they would portray the incredible violence in Haiti and the inability of the rebels when they took over, due to lack of education and resources, to institute much of a, you know, very stable government. And it was presented one way, but on the other side, you had people looking toward America being a model and bringing revolution, and you had a growing number of abolitionists in America who looked hopefully at what was happening in Haiti. And so that increased the divide. And because of the success of the revolution in Haiti, suddenly white slave owners in places like Virginia and the Carolinas and Georgia, they said, my, it worked there. It might work here. This may be an inspiration for our slaves to rise up, and it may show that we're not able to break them down. And that helped cause, when Prosser's Rebellion came or things like that, that fed a violent reaction that wanted to nip this in the bud.
Of course, Gabriel's Rebellion was put down and its participants held to account. This is perhaps an interesting point in American pragmatic politics, because the reprisals, though there was violence, were not as brutal or complete as they could have been. What do you think was the reasoning behind the decisions that led to the reaction to Gabriel's Rebellion?
Well, with Gabriel's Rebellion in particular, of course, it was nipped in the bud, in the sense that because of the timing of the rainstorm and the they looked back, they caught it because some members got cold feet and talked ahead of time, and they were able to, Governor Monroe was able to act quickly. They were able to suppress it before it actually led to a uprising. And the fact that some of the possible participants then turned on it, and it was a slave, another slave that turned in, Gabriel Prosser. It was other slaves that talked. That led to a general sense that, look, we need to maintain slavery. we've got to be firm in our dealing with the rebels, but we also must deal with it in a way that seems in some way fair and appropriate to the situation. So the fact that it was caught when it was caught, and the way it was caught, and the role freed blacks played in it, the way it was interpreted, there was a firm closure, but also one that they thought that the white leaders in Virginia, who tried to deal with this in a manner that they could return back to the previous situation and didn't move into a situation where you would need constant arms suppression of this massive slave population that Virginia had. Further, one interesting aspect that often gets overlooked about Gabriel's Rebellion is that it occurred during an election cycle. It occurred during the election of 1800. And that was an election that pit Jefferson against Adams. It was expected to be a very close election, and it was a very partisan election. Gabriel's Rebellion played into it in complicated ways. Virginia was, of course, strongly backing Jefferson and his party. Governor Monroe was a key supporter of Jefferson. Madison, of course, was his campaign manager, as it were. And the other side was John Adams. Now, John Adams, the Federalist candidate, of course, John Adams was the only person who signed the Declaration of Independence, who never owned slaves. He was not a supporter of slavery. And his party, which was rooted in the North, tended to be, to the extent this was possible, tended to be more abolitionist, more opposed to slavery, and had been criticizing Jefferson as a slave owner. He was a slave owner. Adams isn't a slave owner. That was part of the partisan divide. So now you see a revolution happening right in the middle of it. And so in dealing with it, the Federalist Party, the party of John Adams, was playing, well, look where Jefferson's policies are getting to you. There was already talk about Jefferson and his relationship with his own being a slave owner and his relationship with slaves. That was already a matter of conversation. And so it was very consciously thought, and you can read it in the record. Monroe was talking with Madison and talking with Jefferson. How can we bring this down in a way? If we bring it down too violently, the North will play this up. The Federalists will play this up. Get the immigrants, because a key part of Jefferson's coalition was the immigrants in the North. They were his hope to take New York and to take Pennsylvania. And these people didn't like slavery. And it turns out that key to Jefferson's victory are New York and Pennsylvania, because he has to win when he lost 4 years ago. So if there had been too violent a suppression of the blacks in Virginia, it would play into Federalist hands. And so they consciously tried to make a reaction that was enough to stop the revolt and discourage slaves from revolting again and freed blacks from revolting again, but not enough to alienate the immigrants and other groups that were part of the Jeffersonian coalition in the North.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral Way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code WONDERY to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So returning to rebellion in general, throughout American history, we understand the difference, nominally at least, between rebellion and protest. We haven't seen an armed rebellion in quite a long time, certainly not of the scale that America saw early in its years. But I was wondering if you could perhaps give us a definitional difference between rebellion and protest, and why perhaps we remain a protesting nation, but not a rebellious one.
There's a continuum between a revolution and a gathering and assembly to protest. And all through American history, we can see things along that continuum. And so you look back in the 1960s. Well, what about the disturbances? And there were more than disturbances in Watts, in Los Angeles, or in Detroit, or in the streets of Chicago during the Democratic Convention. Or go back to the time of the Depression, and we look at the protests that would lead in violence in some cases by the veterans marches or the march or the large groups of people living in Hoovervilles around the country. Go back further and look at the draft riots during the Civil War, or even the draft riots and the reaction to the draft in World War I. But the Civil War was the most dramatic. And so these things fall on a continuum, running from pitched revolt to localized disturbances to simply people, such as happening now, gathering at their state capitals in groups beyond the officially accepted size, protesting the closures of businesses and the lockdown. One of the factors is none of those have become national. They remain regional, whether it be the draft riots during the Civil War were mostly in New York, or even the civil rights uprisings, they would be in certain cities like Detroit or Los Angeles, but not nationwide at the same time. But in a deeper sense, this is the nature of the American political system, the pragmatic nature of the American people, that we have shock absorbers, that then we have elections, then people can channel their concerns to electing a new government, a new mayor, a new city council, a new governor, a new senator. And by being able to re-challenge our protests into distinct political parties that absorb some of the concerns, maybe some of the civil rights concerns, or maybe some of the law and order concerns, or maybe some of the concerns about the draft, and absorb them into their policies. So we go from an internationalist country as we were under Wilson to an isolationist country as we were under Harding to deal with the disturbances that were coming up during the end of the First World War. We end up having these shock absorbers that deal with these concerns, you know, maybe only half a loaf, maybe only part way, but enough to calm the waters and allow us to move ahead in sort of that pragmatic one day at a time, maybe short-sighted, but ultimately workable fashion that has become characteristic of the American people.
Well, Ed Larson, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, it's been an honor. I've truly enjoyed being on your show. Thank you for your questions.
That was my conversation with Edward J. Larson, history professor and Hugh and Hazel Darling Chair in Law at Pepperdine University. Larson's authored at least three books: The Return of George Washington, Uniting the States, 1783 to 1789, A Magnificent Catastrophe, The Tumultuous Election of 1800, and his newest, Franklin and Washington, The Founding Partnership. You can find links to these books in the episode description. Next on American History Tellers, on December 7th, 1941, hundreds of Japanese warplanes rained death and destruction down on the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor. The sneak attack shocked the nation and drew it into World War II. The U.S. had been ravaged by the Great Depression. Mobilizing the country for war would require unprecedented government intervention in industry, the economy, and American lives. In our next two-part series, we'll look back at the home front during World War II and how the crisis sparked new opportunities, challenges, and questions about what it meant to be a patriot and an American during a time of crisis. From Wondery, this is American History Tellers. American History Tellers is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. This episode was produced by Audrey Ngo. Executive producers are Jenny Lauer Beckman and Marcia Louie. Created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.